Last night, I made you all dirty with the terrible things we had to think about. And I hope that it's a little better tonight. And I bless Bert and Dave for giving us a shower afterwards. And the title I have for tonight is Drama in History. And I'm going to be speaking down here, if you don't mind. And I have quite a few overheads to use. So I'll just get started. When Jesus came on the scene about 2,000 years ago, the political surroundings were Roman. But there were still a lot of Greek things that were still in place. The Greek language was being used even while Latin was coming into use. And the Romans renamed the Greek gods, like from Zeus, which is Greek, to Jupiter, which is Roman, etc. Okay, so we have a Greek world that was becoming Roman. Now, a major part of the Greek world was drama. And they had comedies and tragedies. But they lived in non-modern times, and they had to do their dramas someplace. Well, they did them in places like this. And the speakers at the bottom of that, where they're doing their drama, had to speak in voices that all those people could hear. And those amphitheaters were built in certain ways that the voice carried to the people who were sitting on those steps. It's quite impressive. I don't know where this particular amphitheater is located, but you can tell it's Greek because of the way it's designed, just the way it is. Okay, you can see the people down here. Gives you a little idea of the size of this place. Here's another Greek amphitheater, and once again, you can see the size of the people. How many thousand people do you think that would hold? Quite a few. I wonder if it ever got full. In the book of Acts, chapter 19, it says, "Now when they heard this, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, 'Great is Diana of the Ephesians.' So the whole city was filled with confusion and rushed into the theater with one accord, having seized Paul's travel companions. And then some of the officials of Asia who were with his friends pled that he would not venture into the theater." Now, by this time, it's probably a Roman arrangement, not necessarily a Greek like I showed you. We'll look at some Roman structures here shortly. All right, so Apostle Paul becomes the center of attention, or they wanted to make him center of attention in a theater. So the Christian man was the focus of the theater. Kind of an interesting situation. And then here in 1 Corinthians 4, we have these words: "For I think that God has displayed us, the apostles, last, as men condemned to death, for we have been made a spectacle to the world, both to angels and to men." In other words, we're the ones who are watched down there on the floor of that theater. We're playing, except it's not playing. It's real life. And guess who are the spectators sitting in the stands? Angels. Believe it or not, the same thing happens today. The angels are watching us on the theater, except we're not pretending. We're in real life. And there are not only angels watching us, there are other men watching us too, playing out on this theater. Here's my last Greek picture. Again, you know, this, it's open air. I don't know where it is. I don't know where the city it is. But there were many of these places built by the Greeks and then later on used by the Romans. But the Romans did something more. I'll show you that next. Movies are drama captured on film. There was no such thing as film in Jesus' day. Everything was live. Live drama. Live theater, which was a part of the Roman society. I understand that this particular amphitheater is in present-day France. That is a Roman creation. It looks like a stadium, doesn't it? People went into that, sat on those, that's all stone or concrete, and that's where they watched various kinds of games. What I have here is a copy of Josephus, his book of Antiquities, book 15, chapter 8, and I'm not going to read everything here, but this is Herod, referring to Herod, which was in Jesus' day. He says, "For in the first place he appointed solemn games to be celebrated every fifth year in honor of Caesar, and built a theater at Jerusalem, as also a very great amphitheater in the plain." Now, I don't know anything about the amphitheater in the plain, but I do have a picture of the theater he built in Jerusalem. Now, this is just a model. Nobody knows exactly what it looked like because it's been destroyed. But this is what they think it looked like. This is Herod's theater. Probably Jesus saw this. Probably Apostle Paul saw this. It says, Herod the Great had also built a theater in the upper city. It was a large open-air auditorium with semicircular rows of seats ascending from a central stage. Wealthy Jews came there to watch the best of Greek and Roman drama. Most traditional Jews, however, scorned this and other outgrowths of Greco-Roman culture as immoral. Unfortunately, nothing remains of its construction. I'm planning to read to you extensively from this book, History of the Christian Church by Philip Schaft. This is volume 2, referring to Ante-Nicene Christianity. That means before Nicaea. Nicaea, we could say 325. Okay, this is the situation in the early church. Now, please pardon me. Speakers are not supposed to read extensively, but I'm going to break the rule tonight, and I just beg your indulgence. Listen carefully as I read, because I can't say it any better. And I'm reading out of a book, and if you want to, you can close your eyes. You can concentrate better. And I'm just going to break right in here. First of all, it's Tertullian writing this. He says, "What is more blessed," asked Tertullian, "than reconciliation with God our Father and Lord, than the revelation of the truth, the knowledge of error, than the forgiveness of so great past misdeeds? Is there a greater joy than disgust with earthly pleasure, than contempt for the whole world, than true freedom, than an unstained conscience, than contentment in life and fearlessness in death?" Contrast with this the popular amusements of the heathen, the theater, the circus, and the arena. I want to pick up right here. You probably have all seen pictures of this. This is the Colosseum that was built in Rome. This is, we'll say, the theater in Rome. It's still standing today. And once again, you can see human beings. Gives you a little size, a little perception of the size of this place. Okay, let's take a look inside. Sorry, that's not a color picture. I have a color picture if you'd like to see. But this was all covered by floor. This is a recent photo, and you can see a portion of the floor over here. But this floor extended all the way over to here. And the games, the gladiatorial contests, all happened right here while people sat up here and watched. And were spectacles, were spectators of what was going on down below. And here is one of the things that went on down below. You probably have seen this picture too. This is inside. And you notice the floor is on here. And in this case, these are Christians who are the spectacles. They are providing the drama. In this particular picture, you notice that there's pillars here, and there's one Christian tied to one pillar, covered with tar, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, in this picture, probably a whole lot more, and then lit on fire. And here are a band of Christians, defenseless people, being ready to be offered in a sacrifice to God. And these people are witnessing this offer, this offering. And the Golgotha height that's going on here is very powerful. The Golgotha height here is so powerful that we have this picture today. I'm going to keep this up, this picture up as I continue to read. We're talking about the popular amusements of the heathen. These amusements were originally connected with festivals of the gods, but had long lost their religious character and degenerated into nurseries of vice. Tertullian represents it as the temple of Venus and Bacchus, who are close allies as patrons of lust and drunkenness. The circus, which is not this picture. See, in addition to an arena, Rome had a circus too. And the circus is where the chariot races happened. And if you've read Ben-Hur, you've read what happened in the circus. This is the Colosseum. This is the theater. The circus was devoted to horse and chariot races, hunts of wild beasts, military displays, and athletic games, and attracted immense multitudes. The impatient crowd, says the historian of declining Rome, rushed at the dawn of day to secure their places, and there were many who passed a sleepless and anxious night in the adjacent porticos. From the morning to the evening, careless of the sun or of the rain, the spectators, who sometimes amounted to the number of 400,000, remained in eager attention, their eyes fixed on the horses and charioteers, their minds agitated with hope and fear for the success of the colors which they espoused. It's a little bit like professional sports today. You know how people are fans of certain teams? Well, back in those days, they were fans of certain charioteers. And the happiness of Rome appeared to hang on the event of a race. The same immoderate ardor inspired their clamors and their applause as often as they were entertained with the hunting of wild beasts and the various modes of theatrical representation. The most popular and at the same time the most inhuman and brutalizing of these public spectacles were the gladiatorial fights in the arena. There, murder was practiced as an art from sunrise to sunset, and myriads of men and beasts were sacrificed to satisfy the savage curiosity and thirst for blood. At the inauguration of the Flavian amphitheater, from 5,000 to 9,000 wild beasts were slain in one day. No less than 10,000 gladiators fought in the feast which Trajan gave to the Romans after the conquest of Dacia, and which lasted 4 months. Under Probus, AD 281, as many as 100 lions, 100 lionesses, 200 leopards, 300 bears, and 1,000 wild boars were massacred in a single day. The spectacles of the worthless Quirinus, 284, who selected his favorites and even his ministers from the dregs of the populace, are said to have surpassed those of his predecessors. The gladiators were condemned criminals, captives of war, slaves, and professional fighters. In times of persecution, innocent Christians were not spared, and that's what's in picture here. But thrown before lions and tigers, painted savages from Britain, blonde Germans from the Rhine and Danube. Stop. Did you know that our relatives were there? We're all descendants here of the barbarians, the Germans. So this is personal for us. Some of our grandpappies or uncles to our grandpappies were actually here. Negroes from Africa and wild beasts, then much more numerous than now, from all parts of the world were brought to the arena. Domitian arranged fights of dwarves and women. The emperors patronized these various spectacles as the surest means of securing the favor of the people, which clamored for bread and circuses. And these shows were provided free by the political leaders to keep the people happy. Enormous sums were wasted on them from the public treasury and private purses. Augustus set the example. Nero was so extravagantly liberal in this direction that the populace forgave his horrible vices and even wished his return from death. The parsimonious Vespasian built the most costly and colossal amphitheater the world has ever seen, encrusted with marble, decorated with statues, and furnished with gold, silver, and amber. Titus presented thousands of Jewish captives after the capture of Rome to the provinces of the east for slaughter in the arena. If they didn't get killed at Jerusalem, in fact, they didn't want to always kill everybody. They wanted to capture a bunch to bring them home to provide the spectacles in the arena. Even Trajan and Marcus Aurelius made bountiful provision for spectacles. And the latter, stoic as he was, charged the richest senators to gratify the public taste during his absence from Rome. Some emperors, as Nero, Commodus, and Caracalla, were so lost to all sense of dignity and decency that they delighted and gloried in histrionic and gladiatorial performances. Nero died by his own hand with the explanation, "What an artist perishes in me." Commodus appeared no less than 735 times on the stage in the character of Hercules, with club and lion skin, and from a secure position killed countless beasts and men. It was a false deal. They made sure he didn't die at all. But he was made to look like a powerful man with a club and, what does it say? Yeah, lion skin. The theatrical passion was not confined to Rome. It spread throughout the provinces. Every considerable city had an amphitheater, and that was the most imposing building, as many may be seen to this day in the ruins at Pompeii, Capua, Puteoli, Verona, Nimes, and I already showed you that one, Augustodunum, and other places. Public opinion favored these demoralizing amusements almost without a dissenting voice. Even such a noble heathen as Cicero commended them as excellent schools of courage and contempt of death. Epictetus alludes to them with indifference. Seneca is the only Roman author who, in one of his latest writings, condemned the bloody spectacles from the standpoint of humanity, but without effect. Paganism has no proper conception of the sanctity of human life. And even the Stoic philosophy, which might disapprove of bloody games as brutal and inhuman, did not condemn them as the sin of murder. To this gigantic evil, the Christian church spoke in the interest of virtue and humanity. No compromise was possible with such shocking public immorality. Nothing would do but to flee from it and to warn against it. The theatrical spectacles were included in the pomp of the devil, which Christians renounced at their baptism. They were forbidden, on pain of excommunication, to attend them. It sometimes happened that converts who were overpowered by their old habits and visited the theater either relapsed into heathenism or fell for a long time into a state of deep dejection. Tatianus calls the spectacles terrible feasts in which the soul feeds on human flesh and blood. Tertullian attacked them without mercy, even before he joined the rigorous Montanus. He reminds the catechumens, or the people in instruction class in those days, who were about to consecrate themselves to the service of God, that, quote, "the condition of faith and the laws of Christian discipline forbid, among other sins of the world, the pleasures of the public shows," end of quote. "They excite," he says, "all sorts of wild and impure passions, anger, fury, and lust, while the spirit of Christianity is a spirit of meekness, peace, and purity. What a man should not say, he should not hear. All licentious speech, nay, every idle word is condemned by God. The things which defile a man in going out of his mouth defile him also when they go in at his eyes and ears. The true wrestlings of the Christian are to overcome unchastity by chastity, perfidy by faithfulness, cruelty by compassion and charity." In two other treatises, he warned the Christian women against all display of dress in which the heathen women shone in temples, theaters, and public places. "Visit not such places," says he to them, "and appear in public only for earnest reasons. The handmaids of God must distinguish themselves even outwardly from the handmaids of Satan, and set the latter a good example of simplicity, decorum, and chastity." Constantine, even as late as 313, committed a great multitude of defeated barbarians to the wild beasts for the amusement of the people, and was highly applauded for this generous act by a heathen order. But after the Council of Nicaea in 325, he issued the first prohibition of those bloody spectacles in times of peace and kept them out of Constantinople. "There is scarcely," says a liberal historian of moral progress, "any other single reform so important in the moral history of mankind as the suppression of the gladiatorial shows. And this feat must be almost exclusively ascribed to the Christian church." When we remember how extremely few of the best and greatest men of the Roman world had absolutely condemned the games of the amphitheater, it is impossible to regard without the deepest admiration the unwavering and uncompromising consistency of the church fathers' denunciations. In other words, the early church had only one condition. There was no compromise on this. The lines were clear. Now we move beyond this period of history. Some of this will be in review, first of all. Drama in history. As we've noted, drama was present in the Roman culture surrounding Jesus and the apostles. And interestingly, in the story that we find in the book of Acts, they are the spectacles. They're not the spectators in any of those events. What you and I both know of Jesus, how in the world could Jesus have gone to one of these places? Can you imagine Apostle Peter sitting in an amphitheater? And so Jesus and the apostles ignored drama as a communication medium. And thank you, Brother Lowell, for what you read tonight. Instead, they proclaimed the foolishness of preaching and sanctioned that as the communication medium. Early Christians placed in the arena to be killed by wild beasts as crowd amusement. A fact. And as we've already noted, the early church condemned drama, period. And as we've already noted, the early church refused to baptize those who participated in drama, as well as those who watched drama for pleasure. Again, no compromise. The line was straight. Tertullian condemned plays as inconsistent with Christian meekness, peace, and purity. Tertullian, on the ground of immodesty alone, Christians are barred from the theater because the theater is the home of immodesty. The decadent church revived drama approximately 1000 AD. To enliven the resurrection theme at Easter time. Somebody decided that since most people were illiterate, it might be good to employ drama to teach some of the gospel. And so, drama came into the church approximately 1000 AD. And drama was used to develop other Christian themes. Drama is effective. Drama communicates. Drama communicated well with the resurrection, so why not expand the use of drama to other Christian themes? And so, one thing went to another. We have mystery plays, which develop religious themes, that move to a platform outside the cathedral and presented in the common language of the people as a teaching mechanism. And then it took another step. They became processional plays performed on carts, on a wagon. You have a stage, a movable stage. You have a play, and then you move the wagon to the next town, and you have the play again. So you have a movable cast of characters. Or you can just move it within the same town, providing a succession of audiences. And by 1500, drama had become a tradition in the Roman Catholic Church. We have to remember that one of the main reasons they did this is for teaching. And illiteracy was just everywhere. And the reason that stained glass windows also came into the church, every stained glass window is a story. It's a religious story. And art in the Catholic Church became a teaching opportunity. So there's lots of art to teach. And by the way, the cathedrals were built with high ceilings, very high ceilings, to instill a sense of majesty and to bring people to worship. Art was very important in this respect as a teaching mechanism. With the Counter-Reformation, which is what happened in the Roman Catholic Church in response to the Protestant reformers, the Roman Catholic Church recognized the power of religious drama if doctrinally correct. And we could say, with this then, drama was baptized by the Roman Catholic Church if it said the right things. But the broad humor and the bawdiness of drama offended the spiritual sensibilities of the reformers, such as John Calvin and Ulrich Zwingli, and I suppose Martin Luther. And when the Protestant reformers came on the scene, especially Ulrich Zwingli, he de-emphasized art. In fact, he encouraged people to pull down some of the art in their church buildings. And here we are as Anabaptist people, and now we consider austere church buildings to be a virtue. And the reason is, we do not understand art as a major communication medium. We understand that spiritual sensibilities are developed by the Spirit of God, not by external art. And so, when our people came on the scene 500 years ago, Anabaptism basically ignored it in its struggle to survive persecution. And we have gained a tradition that has kept that to this day. Thank you for your attention. I'll cease there.